Good evening. This is Elaine Ireland. You're listening to Going Global for Spirit with Elaine Ireland on BBSRadio.com. We are the world's number one internet talk radio network on the planet. And in a few moments, I'll give you two different numbers. One is a worldwide number, and another one that is a number shared by the United States and Canada for you to be able to call in and ask questions of our guest tonight, Mario Beauregard, Ph.D. He has written a book with his associate Denise O'Leary called The Spiritual Brain, A Neuroscientist's Case for the Existence of the Soul. And I have to tell you, sir, welcome so much to my show. I'm so excited about this book. I just told him a moment ago that I could keep him on the air probably 4 or 5 hours on this. It's been fascinating to me as a practicing psychic, this, and very much a believer in the spirit and the soul, to be able to read this book from a different, read about the subject from a scientific point of view, and yet written with a great deal of love and respect. Thank you, and so welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you.
You're in Canada? Are you in Canada?
In Montreal, yes.
Montreal. Mm-hmm. I've only had one call from Canada, so maybe tonight we will have some callers, some of your followers.
Mm-hmm.
You sent me a list of questions that I've found fascinating, but the very first one is the mind an illusion created by the brain, and the first word, materialist, generally say yes. Tell us what you mean by materialist.
Well, materialism is the mainstream view in modern science, and especially in modern neuroscience. And so neuroscience is the discipline that investigates the mind in relation with the brain. And for most neuroscientists, current neuroscientists, the mind is what the brain does. So in other words, you can reduce all mental processes like perception, memory, emotion, even spiritual experiences and spiritual states to electrical and chemical activity in the brain. So this is the mainstream materialist view in neuroscience.
And you go on to say that non-materialist neuroscientists demonstrate that the mind is real and can change the brain.
Yes, because there's an increasing amount of evidence showing that what we call mind can exert a very significant influence over brain activity. For instance, if you take the case of the placebo effect, it's a very nice demonstration of this powerful effect of mind over brain activity, because the placebo effect is based on a certain number of beliefs or attitudes and expectations toward a certain treatment. It can be a pill or any other form of treatment. And there are many brain imaging studies now that have shown that expectations toward a treatment can modify significantly brain activity. For instance, there has been a very interesting study done in Canada by a neurologist in Vancouver about 5 years ago, and they gave a placebo treatment to people suffering from a very advanced form of Parkinson's disease. And in Parkinson's disease, there's a major deterioration of the nerve cells or the neurons that produce a chemical messenger that is called dopamine. And this chemical messenger is involved in all sorts of functions, including motor functioning. And so in the case of the patients receiving the placebo treatment, they started to produce dopamine in amounts very comparable to normal healthy volunteers in the study. And in that case, the patients, they displayed a destruction of the dopaminergic neurons of about 80% in the brain. So this is a very elegant demonstration of how the mind can modulate neurochemical activity in the brain. And we have many other examples of this phenomenon. So that's why I'm arguing in the book that it's not possible to reduce mind to an illusion or to only electrical and chemical processes in the brain, because beliefs, emotions, expectations can markedly influence electrical and chemical activity in the brain.
So you're saying that mind and brain are identical?
No, they are not at all.
They're not identical.
We cannot reduce systematically mind to brain and vice versa. This is what I'm proposing, but most neuroscientists interested in the so-called mind-body problem or mind-brain problem does not believe like that. They support the materialistic view regarding this question.
I like what you say here. They think that the mind relates to the brain the way a movie relates to your TV set.
Yes, exactly.
It does not create the program, it shows it.
Yes.
What a wonderful example.
Yeah, yeah. It's a nice metaphor.
Yes. Yes, it is. I really enjoyed this book. I'm not a scientist by any stretch of the imagination,
mm-hmm.
but I so enjoyed the way you used the science without, and I have to say this, making it so college level that it was really difficult to read. So
right.
Folks out there, don't be afraid of the word neuroscientist on the front of this book and the PhD behind his name, because he writes to the public. Yes, I've had to go back and read three or four times a certain pages, but it was well worth the effort for me to get past the two or three first chapters, because you have to have that in order to get to the spiritual brain part. After I read it, I looked on the back of the cover. Did God create the brain, or does the brain create God? And I almost wish that was chapter 10, really. And I almost wish you had put that at the beginning, because that chapter helped me understand 2 and 3 and 4 a little bit better. Mm-hmm. But let's answer that question. Did God create the brain, or does the brain create God?
Well, it's a matter of perspective, because we could say that it's both. Because, of course, human beings have always, throughout history, created mental representations about the concept of God or divinity in all sorts of spiritual traditions. But at the same time, it's clear that now there's increasing evidence, if you study cosmology, the beginning of the universe, that you need a very fine tuning of the fundamental laws and also certain constants in the universe for planet Earth to emerge at some point in the universe, and also for mind and consciousness to emerge at a later point during evolution. And more and more scientists agree with this view. So that's why I'm saying that it's both. It's, of course, we always try to create representations about what we don't know exactly, what it's hard to perceive or, you know, to capture. But at the same time, I think that you need an intelligent designer to be able to create the physical universe and also human beings. So I think that evolution is guided at the origin, at the beginning, by a fabulous intelligence, which is at the origin of everything in the universe.
So we cannot say that neuroscientists can demonstrate the existence of God following the studies and the research that you've done. That's not your point here.
No, because what we do when we use, for instance, brain imaging technologies, the scanners, and the tools that I use on a regular basis. For instance, a few years ago we did a study with Carmelite nuns, and we were interested to see what was going on in their brains during a mystical state, a state of union with God, as they would say. And so essentially, when we do this, we're measuring what we call neural correlates of a certain state or experience, in that case of neural correlates of a mystical experience. And these correlates are simply biophysical phenomena occurring in the brain, but so they are phenomena that accompany something going on at the mental level or spiritual level. But we cannot say that these correlates are the cause of the experience. So there's no causality involved in this relationship. So that's why I'm saying that it's very dangerous to try to reduce all kinds of experience at the mind level or spiritual experiences to these correlates. If we want to push further this question, you can examine a very interesting case of near-death studies, clinical death. In the book, I'm reporting the case of one woman. Her name is Pam Reynolds, and about 15 years ago, she underwent a form of surgery that we call standstill. She was suffering from a major aneurysm, which is a blood vessel that was swollen, and this blood vessel was located in the brainstem. So the brainstem is the part of the brain which controls all the vital functions, such as heart rhythm and also breathing. And her life was threatened, and she heard of a neurosurgeon in Phoenix, Arizona, Dr. Robert Spindler, who about 30 years ago devised a surgical procedure called standstill. And in the standstill procedure, the heart is totally stopped, then the blood is drained from the head, and the body temperature is decreased to 58 degrees Fahrenheit for a certain period of time, which can range from about 15 minutes to about an hour. So in her case, she was clinically dead for about 60 minutes. Whenever you stop the heart functioning, the brain activity will shut down after 10 to 15 seconds normally. So if you measure brain activity with EEG or electroencephalography, which measures electrical activity, you will notice that the EEG becomes totally flat after 10 to 15 seconds. So this is exactly what happened in her case. But what's fascinating is that at a certain point during the surgery, she reported having the impression of floating above her physical body, so she was able to see her and see all the surgeons and the nurses during the surgery. And she was very she was able to report very accurately some dialogues exchanged between the neurosurgeon and the nurses and the cardiologist who was there. And also she was able to draw very precisely certain surgical instruments that were used during the surgery. And all this was happening while she was clinically dead. And at a later point during her experience, she's had the impression of traveling very quickly along a tunnel. And at the end of the tunnel, she met with deceased relatives and friends. And in the last phase of her experience, she met with a beautiful being of light, and for her, this being of light was God, and her life was totally transformed after this near-death experience, and it's the first case that we have in science where we know for sure that there was no brain activity, and yet the person was able to perceive, to be conscious, to have feelings, etc. So this case, and now there are other cases as well, strongly suggest that mind and consciousness can operate independently of the brain.
While you take a breath there, let me give phone numbers. Now that you folks have had a listen to what we're talking about, please feel free to call in and ask questions, share a story, comment on something. The worldwide number is 877-489-6350. The United States and Canada share a number, 1-888-228-4494. Canada and the United States, 1-888-228-4494. Worldwide, 877-489-6350. 6350. This is Elaine Ireland going global for spirit. My guest tonight is the author, one of the authors of The Spiritual Brain, a neuroscientist case for the existence of the soul, which is exciting to me, Mario Beauregard, PhD, and his colleague Denise O'Leary. And tell us about Denise O'Leary. We have to spotlight her. Her name
yeah,
is on the book.
Yeah, she's a science writer based in Toronto, Canada. And she writes a lot about biology, and she's also very much interested in the intelligent design controversy in the United States. So she writes a lot about this topic as well.
Explain that for our public.
Well, the intelligent controversy is the it's the movement, you know, that. You know, you have main proponents like William Dembski, for instance, in the United States, and others also, who claim that the evolution is guided by an intelligent designer. But in their views, this intelligent designer is intervening always in the evolutionary process, all the time. So it's a different view than, for instance, Francis Collins, the guy who mapped the human genome. Collins believes that everything was created by an intelligent designer, but at the beginning of everything, before the emergence of the Big Bang in the universe. So it's a different way of seeing things. And, of course, the people who favor the Darwinian theory are totally against this view of this notion of intelligent design. So there's a battle raging since about a decade in the United States and regarding this question. And Denise O'Leary is very much interested in this issue.
You refer to that in your book, too.
A bit, yes.
Yes.
But I'm not an expert on biological evolution, so I prefer to focus on mind-brain questions and consciousness.
What made you write?
Spirituality also.
What got you there? What got you to this book?
Personal experiences that I've had since my childhood. When I was very young, I started when I was about 8 years old, and at that time I was living on a farm, and I had a lot of space, you know. I was playing in fields and forests, and I had a lot of space and time to reflect about these questions. And very, very young, I was fascinated by these questions, you know, the relationship between mind and brain and the soul, spirituality, God. I don't know why, but it's like that. And I've had several mystical insights, if you will, starting at a very early age, and also during my teenage years, and as a young adult also. So these experiences have greatly influenced the kind of work that I'm doing today.
There is somewhere in here I want to find it. I think I marked it. What is a mystic?
A mystic.
Yes, I wanted to read it because that word, you're right, somewhere in here you tell us that word is misused.
Oh, yes, because it's it has a negative connotation, but in reality it's something which is beautiful, because the true mysticism refers to the this feeling of a connection with a higher principle, with the intelligence, and the intelligence at the origin of everything in the universe. So mystics very often will feel united with everything that exists in the universe, including other human beings, for instance. And so that's the kind of experience that I've had myself when I was younger. And so it seems that these experiences happened across all cultures and across history. And they are very similar if you take a look at all the various spiritual traditions. However, the terms that will be used in the various spiritual traditions may differ. And but there seems to be a common core across all the great spiritual traditions regarding these mystical experiences.
One of the chapters is who has mystical experiences and what triggers them, which is caught my eye because as a practicing psychic, the word mystic and psychic are often assumed to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a thin line.
Right.
Between it. So true mysticism is active and practical.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Not passive or theoretical. It
no,
is an organic
no.
life process, a
mm-hmm.
something this whole self does, not something about which its intelligence, its intellect holds an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Thanks.
That was credited to Evelyn Underhill.
Yes.
1911
yes.
posted a somewhat
yes.
different list, and that was number one on her list.
Yes. Yes, she's one of the first who have studied in a very rigorous fashion mysticism, and she was a mystic herself. And she made a lot of progress trying to understand this phenomenon of mysticism. So we refer a lot to her throughout our book.
Yes. 1911, that's amazing to me that
yes.
the research goes back that far.
Yeah, right.
And probably way beyond that, too, truth be told.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me about the idea of the God gene. When I read that, I went, oh, here we go again.
Mm-hmm.
The God gene talk. There's such a controversy about that.
Yes. Well, it's another form of extreme reductionism. So in this case, instead of trying to reduce spirituality and spiritual experiences to brain processes, for instance, electrical and chemical activity in the brain, we try to reduce spirituality and spiritual experiences to the activity of a single gene, you know. So this is an extraordinary claim, but it is not supported at all empirically, you know, by scientific evidence. So the author of that book, The God Gene, Dean Hammer, mm-hmm. is a molecular geneticist at the NIH, and he backed up a lot in recent years regarding the assertions that you can find in his book. And he's been accused of extreme reductionism, like I was saying before, because we know now that for every types of behavior, you have thousands of genes that are involved, and also you have interaction between all these genes. So it's very, very complex, and there's no way you can reduce something very as complex as spirituality and spiritual experiences to a single gene. So the problem with this is that it is not at all supported scientifically. So he's been very heavily criticized in recent years because of this.
What interests me, or what triggered something for me, was that not all cultures believe in a god. They call it different things.
Exactly, yes.
So I can see where somebody claiming that there is a God gene could get into trouble with other cultures, besides
absolutely.
The scientific field. To me, it's all the same energy with just a lot of different names. But unfortunately,
right.
other cultures don't. Not every culture looks at it that way. If they get offended.
Yes.
So that God helmet was just. I'd read about the God helmet before too, and that was fascinating to me the way you presented that. And I did not know that all of this had happened with the God helmet. That so much work had been done. I knew it existed, but I didn't know it had gone so far.
Yeah. Michael Persinger devised this helmet, and he's a neuroscientist, but at the same time, he's an overtly atheist and materialist. And so his goal, for him, he believes that religion and spirituality are cognitive viruses, that's what he's claiming. And so he wants to demonstrate that all these spiritual experiences and also psychic experiences are simply misfiring of neurons in a region of the brain that is called the temporal lobe. And the basic point to start with this view is the fact that neurologists about 30 years ago discovered a few patients in which the epileptic seizures were located in this region, the temporal lobe. And these patients sometimes were reporting religious or spiritual experiences. So these neurologists concluded that these experiences were simply the byproducts of an abnormal brain. And Persinger reasoned that if this is true, then it should be possible in principle to induce systematically these experiences simply by stimulating electromagnetically the temporal lobes. So he created this so-called God helmet, and he claims that he's able to induce all sorts of interesting experiences, like out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, and also mystical experiences. But a few years ago, a group of Swedish researchers decided to try to replicate his findings, and they used exactly the same material and the same intensity in terms of the magnetic fields that were applied to the temporal lobes, but they discovered that the reported effects were simply the product of suggestibility. And it's important to note that Persinger mostly used psychology students at his university. And also, he recruits only people who are easily, who are good subjects for hypnosis. So they are very easily suggestible. And so that's one of the major flaws of his work. And so there's now a controversy about his work because of this failed replication by the Swedish team. And so it's a very interesting question. It doesn't mean that the temporal lobe are not implicated in spiritual experiences, but to be implicated in such experience does not mean that the region is creating the experience. So this is a very important distinction to make, but Persinger doesn't want to make this distinction because he's totally biased for our materialism, you see.
Are they still doing research with that today as we speak?
They started about 20-some years ago, and they published several papers, but now they don't seem to publish as much, and because they've been so much criticized all over the world, I don't know if Persinger will pursue this this research program.
Another thing that I picked up from your book is the amount of, oh, forgive me if I'm using the wrong word, persecution.
Yes.
That goes on in the scientific, he said, she said world.
Yes.
It was amazing, because on page 26, there's a statement, putting all emotion options on the table. And my thought was, isn't that what all researchers do anyway?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, demand that all options are put on the table. So why do they refuse other theories so harshly, such as the God gene or the helmet? Granted, as scientists, I know there's got to be research, double blinds, another set of blinds.
Mm-hmm.
But while they're doing that and they're trying, one team, let's say, your team, is trying to go the scientific route for the existence of the soul, why would someone criticize you while you're in the process of it just because there hasn't been proof before?
Well, because it's for most scientists, neuroscientists, like I said at the beginning of the interview, they have a materialistic and very reductionistic view of human beings. And so for them, if mind is what the brain does and it does not have any real existence, it's like an illusion or a byproduct. So and it's the same thing for spiritual experiences and mystical states and psychic experiences. So for them, it's silly to want to explore these experiences and to understand the neural underpinnings, because it shouldn't be part of mainstream science. You know, it's we shouldn't take care or, you know, consider these questions because everything is physical, material. So, and because these things are so subjective and they are not objective, they are hard to measure, then they do not exist. And it's this thing started with Galileo and Descartes and, you know, all the founders of modern science, because there's been a switch, you know, a shift toward objective measurement and quantification. And so since you cannot see a feeling or, you know, a spiritual revelation, something like that, an insight, then for most neuroscientists, they do not exist. It's very silly because, so there's a lot of resistance. We're in the same state now regarding these questions than Copernic was 500 years ago, you know, and so, and usually the scientists are, you know, they have their own biases and beliefs, and so the, if you want to present evidence going against the prevailing paradigm, it creates a lot of resistance. So usually it takes a long, long time for revolution, scientific revolutions to occur. You know, it's the same thing happened at the beginning of the 20th century in physics. So it took several decades for quantum physics to supersede classical physics. And so we're in the same situation now.
Step one. This is Elaine Ireland. You're going global for spirit on bbsradio.com. My guest tonight is the author, one of the authors of The Spiritual Brain, A Neuroscientist Case for the Existence of the Soul, Mario Beauregard, Ph.D., and his associate, Denise, and her name is spelled D-E-N-Y-S-E, if you go looking for this, O, apostrophe Leary, L-E-A-R-Y. Mario Beauregard is with us this evening. This is... You have another book in the making, I hope?
Yes.
I had a
many, many books. Yes.
Will they be trailers for this one, or are you attacking another subject in the same field?
Well, in that book, we try to demonstrate that human beings are not biological robots totally determined by their genes and their neurons. And in the next book... I want to pursue this line of reasoning and to demonstrate that if it's really possible for, you know, our minds and our spirits to greatly influence the physical body, what's going on in the brain, and perhaps also even gene expression, because there's, you know, mounting evidence showing this, then it's possible to transform, you know, human beings, the human species, and it would be possible, in principle, to transform this species quite rapidly because now we are not governed by unconscious laws like biological evolution, which took, you know, millions and billions of years, but we can now drive human evolution consciously and volitionally. We have a great power, you know, to influence our biology. And so I want to discuss this this view regarding the impact of such a perspective on global economy and politics and also what's going on in our society. So that's the, you know, the general theme that will be discussed in this book.
When will it be out? Do you know?
Well, I'm starting to work on this thing, but I think it will take a few years before it will be published.
We'll have to keep in touch.
Sure.
Absolutely. Are you going to, forgive me for jumping here, but I wanted to ask you about the Carmelite nuns. You mentioned them a while ago in the study, and And you described that it was a little difficult to get permission and then difficult to convince them, actually, that that your work was on the up and up. Will you do any more work with them? That part of your research was fascinating to me.
I don't think so, because it's been so difficult, and they were cloistered, you know, and so they were not used to leave the monastery, and certainly not used to go to a lab, you know, to be you know, subject of an experimentation, you know, to be put in a scanner, or you know, to wear electrodes on their scalp and stuff like that. So it's it was quite disturbing for them at first, and also the another reason why it was difficult is the following: they told us that according to their belief system, of course, you're not going to be able to prove that you know, the brain creates God, because for them, God created you know, the universe and human species and the brain. And so it was hard for us to convince them that we were not, you know, interested doing this project in a materialist way. We were different than most neuroscientists, and so it's been really hard to convince them of this. And for some of the nuns, they were not seeing the interest of doing this project, because the contemplation, prayer, the mystical feeling of union with God are things that are very intimate, so they didn't want to share this with us. So that's why I'm saying it, that it would be hard to start a new project with this population. But after we were done with them, we started another brain imaging study, but this time we investigated near-death experiencers. And it was very interesting, because these near-death experiencers all experienced the being of light that I was talking about earlier. And they were psychologically and spiritually transformed after this this experience. Many of them were atheists before the experience. And interestingly, they claimed that after the experience, they were able to be on a daily contact, on a daily union with the being of light. And for most of these experiencers, the being of light was very close to our Christian concept, Judeo-Christian concept of God. So they felt that they were connected to this to God, or this source of everything in the universe. So essentially, we ask them to simply enter into a state of union with this light or being of light, and we use a scanner, which is called functional magnetic resonance imaging, and also another technology, EEG, or electroencephalography, to measure electrical activity. And we found very interesting things. Actually, the brain patterns during this this state of union with the being of light is not very different than the pattern that we observed in the Carmelite nuns during the mystical union with God.
When I finished reading about the Carmelite studies, I felt like there's more there.
Oh yes,
so much more there.
For sure.
Either he didn't write about all of it, or there's more to do. Maybe a little
bit. There's more to do. But it would be interesting to also investigate people from other spiritual traditions, you know, in Buddhism or in Islam, and also all the other great spiritual traditions of the world. So we're planning to do this in a near future.
Have you ever, and I ask this because I know someone that was asked to do this, and it was an interesting afternoon. A psychiatrist invited a practicing psychic to his office, and threw words, literally threw words at her, and wanted to know. First, he asked her to get into a meditative state, and he wanted to know if she could sense what part of the brain her response came from. And no electrodes, no nothing. Just where did that come from? It was interesting to watch.
Yeah.
And I don't know what he did with the information. Uh-huh. I was there as an observer, mm-hmm. kind of a chaperone. But it was part of a study that he was doing.
Hmm.
That was in New Mexico.
Wow.
30, 40 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Hmm.
So is that, she swears up and down that she could actually, he asked, he put out his dog's name that came from the left side.
Mm-hmm.
Something about his ankle or his wife's ankle that came from the right side, the response did.
Mm.
Anyway, it was an interesting observation.
Yeah.
And he recorded it. It was long enough ago that he used the reel-to-reel tape recording. You're probably too young to remember those. You probably don't know about those. This is Elaine Ireland. You're going global for spirit on bbsradio.com. And tonight we are visiting with Dr. Mario Beauregard, who has written a book with his colleague Denise O'Leary, The Spiritual Brain, a neuroscientist case for the existence of the soul. And please, folks, don't let the word neuroscientist scare you away. It happens to be what this gentleman is, and that was his approach to finding out about the scientific approach for the case of the existence of the soul. That alone fascinated me because I've been raised and my experiences have been, yes, we have a soul.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to prove it.
But
it's the scientific proof.
Yes, because for scientists, and especially neuroscientists, there's no soul. You know, there's like I said before, the mind and consciousness are byproducts of electrical and chemical activity in the brains, and so there's no soul, really. Soul is just a construction, created by religious people, who believe in this concept. And so that's why we use the subtitle, but it's a bit kind of provocation, if you will, but it was done by the publisher. The publisher insisted that we put this on the... Of course, in neuroscience, we do not really study the soul. We don't use this concept. But when I was talking before of the case of Pam Reynolds, well, you can... perhaps it's related to soul. Because if mental processes and consciousness can occur... even in absence of the brain activity, then these processes must be related to the concept of soul, in my view.
And you don't think that, or maybe I should ask you your opinion of this, a little bit like the 11th monkey, where one person thinks it on this island, and then
mm-hmm.
3 years later it's happening over here, but there's been no communication.
Yes, yes. Well, we discuss these phenomena in the book.
Yes.
These so-called psi phenomena, and they've been investigated a lot by a psychologist, an engineer named Dean Radin, and he published The Conscious Universe and also Entangled Minds, and he summarized about a century of research regarding these questions. And there's overwhelming evidence for the reality of these phenomena. Yet, most scientists today completely deny the existence of these phenomena because they totally threaten the materialistic worldview. So for the scientists, these phenomena are impossible. And the people who claim to be able to to experience these things. Are frauds, illusionist.
Oh dear, I'm a fraud. Okay.
Yeah, and yet many people experience these phenomena on a daily basis throughout the world. So the materialist worldview goes totally against evidence, and it's a sort of dogma. It's a doctrine. And it has become very, very strong. And if you dare challenging this doctrine, then it's very risky for your scientific career.
That's what bothered me. I mentioned it a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
The criticism that people get, and some of them, by your description, almost run out of their field. because they even had an idea that might hold water, so to speak.
Yes.
And they're ostracized.
Yes, absolutely.
For their attitude.
They are not burned, you know, at the stake now, but you know, it's you can experience very negative things still. For instance, regarding your colleagues, your peers, or you can, you know, lose research funding, and you know, it's so it can be very difficult, even at the beginning of the 21st century.
Were you concerned with that at all when you started your research?
No, because I felt that I had a mission in life, and, you know, that was my path. And so I didn't care at all about this, because this sense of mission was greater than anything else.
I admire you for that. Thank you. Thank you for moving forward, you and Ms. O'Leary, both, for doing the research. And I know it was... How long did it take you to put this book together, to do the research in?
A few years. 2 years.
He says that so easily. A few years.
Yes.
This is, folks out there, this is such a detailed book. Don't let the first two chapters scare you. You must get past the first two chapters, even though it is still scientific throughout. There's plenty of explanation and backup. If I can read it as non-scientific as my brain is, anybody can. And it's I learned so much about why there was so much scientific research going into a non-scientific subject. It was the way you wrote it was not like a novel, but kept me there. And yet at the same time, because I'm not a science, my brain doesn't go that way, isn't wired that way. I learned a lot about the brain. And being a practicing psychic, it was great information for me to have.
Sure.
Because in some states, we can still be committed as crazy people because we hear things, see things, smell things, know things that no one else can see at the same time, usually. Mm-hmm. And if our families really wanted to be mean, they could have us committed. So this was good information in self-defense. In some ways. So what you're saying, one of the questions is, who has mystical experiences and what triggers them? And first of all, we need to understand what the word mystical, how the word mystical is used here, because it's not used in the same way as psychic is used, but it's
no.
same family, I think. But and what triggers them? You've already explained that, and I think the world needs to know that is listening to us. In a way, you're saying anyone can.
Yes, well, actually, this is exactly what happens. And so, you know, these experiences can happen to, like I said before, to atheists. And I received many letters following the publication of the book of atheists who became very spiritual after such experiences. And the common triggers for these experiences are very often depression and despair and... but at other times, it can be these experiences can happen during a state of meditation or prayer, and even contemplation of natural sceneries. So these experiences can happen during these conditions, and they also can be associated with the ingestion of certain psychedelic drugs that are called entheogens. So that's another. So it seems that there, you know, you need to have a certain shift in terms of what's going on in the brain, electrically and chemically, to experience a spiritual dimension, if you will. And this shift can happen under various conditions.
Folks, we're not telling you to go buy drugs.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Might sound like fun, but no. Timothy O'Leary has already been there, done that.
Yes.
He would be somebody to really sit down and talk to about that, wouldn't he?
Yes.
If we could, still. Well, you've just answered the other question. Do religious, spiritual, or mystical experiences change lives? Yes, they do.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yes, they do.
And they have very long-term effects, beneficial effects, usually. And so the people who have these experiences, they will become more compassionate, and they have a sense of communion or interconnection with other human beings after that, and with very often with everything in the universe, you know, including plants and animals, and so it's a major transformation, usually psychologically and spiritually.
I'm a teacher, a licensed teacher, and years and years and years ago, even before I was a licensed teacher, during the summertime, I would take 1 week, and I would take children of clients, or children that were referred to me that their parents might think that they have a little something different, they were a little different,
mm-hmm.
and I would only take 4 or 5 at a time, and we would do, I called it my hug-a-tree class, and we would play with water, and in water, and hug a tree, and lay down on the ground, and put a leaf on our forehead, and hold grass in our hands, and get dirty, get in the dirt, get dirty. Look at blooming flowers, plant seeds, do all that sort of the nature thing. Go to walk in Bastrop Park, which is just a beautiful park here. I'm in Central Texas, and it was called my hug a tree, and it was always. A child would say something about seeing something out of the corner of their eye, or mm-hmm. the light, a colored light when they had their eyes closed, or I would teach them how to look at a leaf, just hold a leaf and look at it, and then blink and look at it again and tell me what they saw. Those kids were having some neat experiences,
mm-hmm.
and tell me what they would feel. And what more innocent than a child who's had very little influence? Been blessed with parents that was willing to listen. I certainly didn't look at it as an experiment. I looked at it as an experience for me and for the child, and to help them develop their spirituality, if you will, or their psychic ability. And
And
even after a week, just like 6 hours, I could always see a difference in most of the kids.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say 99% of the kids there was a difference. They were calmer. I taught them how to get to their center. To calm themselves,
mm-hmm.
and how to listen a little better, to be quiet and to listen. It's interesting what happens when you start working with nature, and that you've mentioned that several times.
Yes, it can be very powerful.
Yes, very, very, very powerful. This is Going Global for Spirit with Elaine Ireland, and we have just a few moments, folks, like two, for you to call in with a quick comment or a quick question. Worldwide, that would be 877-489-6350, United States and Canada, 1-888-228-4494. Although I think we're about to run out of time, Dr. Beauregard, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
Will you come back and visit again?
Oh, sure.
About this book or any other in your future, I would be delighted to have you.
Sure.
Anything that you would like to leave with our public? Any final comments or?
Well, you know, I think the take-home message would be that, like I said before, humans are much more than, you know, sophisticated biological robots, you know, determined by genes and neurons. And so they are much more than that, because in mystical experiences, the mystics experience their unity with the underlying source of everything in the universe. And so that's my message for tonight, you know. And the kind of research we're doing demonstrate that it's possible, even incarnated biologically, to have access to this spiritual dimension. And it's very important to get in touch with this this aspect of our inner being, because it has many beneficial effects on our physical health and also on our mental health. And it's very important also to create a better future for the entire human species.
Do you think that... that our world will ever be able to come in agreement about a sense of peace and where it comes from?
I think so, but it will take time, you know, because I believe we're very young as a species. So it's like if we're at the kindergarten. And if you have a very global perspective on this and, you know, we live in a relatively young system, solar system, and because there are stars which are much older than our sun, and so Earth is not that that old at the cosmic level, and so we still have a lot of time, you know, to evolve. But of course, there are multiple dangers ahead, and so we have to be able to evolve rapidly enough to avoid global destruction, of course. But I think it will happen because it seems that there's now an acceleration in terms of human evolution on a global level.
An actual effort being made.
Oh yes, there is. Yes, it's palpable. You know, it's very concrete, tangible now.
Well, I'm going to have to say goodnight and let you go, or sweet Seth is going to whisper in my ear and make me go away. So he's my producer. So I thank you very, very much. I really appreciate your taking the time to share your work and your beliefs with us. It's been just wonderful having you here, and I look forward to having you on the show again soon.
Okay.
Good night.
Thanks a lot.
Folks out there,
bye-bye.
Don't forget to share a smile this world this week. Good night, sir.
Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Joe Vitale. I'm one of the stars of the hit movie The Secret, and I'm the author of way too many books to even list here, including The Attractor Factor and Life's Missing Instruction Manual. You're listening to BBS Radio, so fasten your seatbelts, get ready to be inspired and informed. You're in for a wild ride.
Hi, everybody out there. This is Xenia Seberg. And who are you? Because I'm there. No matter where you are, because this is Dr. Fred Bell's show on BBS Radio.
Health, Science, and Energy show on BBSRadio.com.
We'll make you sound better than you sound right now.
Well, that's a good thing. For me, it's like midnight here. I'm going to bed, which doesn't matter to you guys. Aren't you ready? Stay tuned.
that you